And please, for Mr. Stanley Weinberg, present an argument for the president.
May it please the court, my name is Sam Weinberg, the firm of Levin Weinberg and Levin. Bringing before you today the case of the petitioner, Weldon Robinson and his wife, versus the Preston Chrysler Plymouth Corporation. This case involves a claim under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, the original one, as it was in 1973, and occurred when, back in 1975, when Weldon Robinson and his wife, in response to some ads in the newspapers stating that Preston Chrysler Plymouth had some special shipments of leftover 1974 Chryslers and Plymouth factory special purchases direct from Chrysler Corporation, went to Preston Chrysler Plymouth, wound up purchasing a 1974 Chrysler Newport. Following the purchase, they discovered that there was damage to the vehicle, and after returning the vehicle for repairs and pointing it out to Preston Chrysler Plymouth, brought the lawsuit under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. During that period, it was also discovered that the same automobile had been a leased car prior to the time that it came into the possession of Preston Chrysler and prior to the time that it was sold to Mr. Robinson and his wife. The case was tried in February 1980, and it appears, of course, by the time that by the time of the trial, the Deceptive Trade Practices Act already had undergone changes through legislative action. The time the case went to trial in 1980, the last decision out of the Court of Appeals in Dallas that was looked upon by the trial judge was the case of Pennington versus Singleton. The case was tried prior to this court decision in Pennington versus Singleton. The case was given to the jury to find whether or not Preston Chrysler Plymouth had failed to disclose to the Robinson that the car had been damaged prior to its purchase, and also that the Preston Chrysler Plymouth had failed to inform or disclose to Robinson that the car had been a leased car prior to the time that Preston Chrysler Plymouth obtained it and ran the ad that induced the Robinson to come to the car dealer. The case went to the jury asking if those two matters did occur. The jury found that they did. The trial judge only allowed to the jury the question as to whether or not, if those failures to disclose occurred, whether or not the Robinsons had been adversely affected. The jury found that they had. Judgment was ordered in the trial court for the Robinsons against Preston Chrysler Plymouth, and was taken up on appeal to the Court of Appeals. By the time it got to the Court of Appeals, the Pennington case from this court had been handed down. The Court of Appeals reversed and rendered on two points. One, that since Preston Chrysler's representative did not know that the automobile purchased by the Robinson had been damaged, they had no duty to disclose that, and therefore that was not a deceptive trade practice under the statute 17.46A, which was the general statement in the Deceptive Trade Practices Act as to which practices are unlawful. It's interesting to note that the case as pled asked for issues regarding subsections 5 and 7, which are under 17.46B of the Act, which is the specific, quote, laundry list, unquote, as it is referred to, but that the court did not give those issues, but solely went on the question of adversely affected. There was no objection from Preston Chrysler Plymouth in the trial court in regard to this. The second issue in the Court of Appeals had to do with the question of the lease car issue. And we have actually the horns of a dilemma, sort of. We have two points. One, there was no question from the Court of Appeals opinion that there was proof that the car had been damaged, and apparently that there was damages in regard to market value in the trial court, but held that because failure to disclose without knowledge is not a receptive trade practice, that plaintiff could not recover on that. The second question stated that even though the question of damages necessarily came into the issue given to the trial jury, that there was no evidence, they could not imply that the trial court found that there were damages and therefore reversed and rendered on those grounds. The Honor granted the application for writ of error to hear the first point in the petitioner's application regarding the question of whether or not knowledge is required.
Can I ask you one question about the factory again? Was it shown that this was not a factory purchase direct from Chrysler, or was it one?
Your Honor, the testimony in the trial wound up showing that it was not direct from the factory because the car had been handled elsewhere by a previous owner as a lease car, and that although the record shows that the Robinsons were told that they would obtain title as first purchasers, that they did not receive such a title, that they actually were not the first purchaser. They were the second purchaser in the chain of title purchase. Yes, it was. The ad that referred to direct from Chrysler Corporation used the word factory. Did not say that it came direct from somewhere in the Chrysler Corporation.
But the ad actually saying directly from the factory.
It said in one of the ads that were in evidence in the trial court, in terms of Exhibits 1 and 2, Plaintiff Exhibit 2 stated factory special purchase direct from Chrysler Corporation. Now, obviously, it does not say in the words that you're asking that it came direct from the factory. But I believe in the context that we're doing, we're talking about a representation that would lead a consumer, the average person walking in, to believe that they had here leftover factory purchases that had received in a direct shipment. These were 74 cars purchased.
The trial court did not make the exact
mistake. No, that is failure to disclose were the only issues that were represented. There was a pleading the case actually commenced, in which plaintiff did allege that it was represented the car was new. And it wasn't, but an emotion in limine granted by the trial court that was kept out of the actual trial. So no issue in the question of whether or not you're dealing with a used car that was supposedly represented to be a new car was given to the jury. That did not get. The question that comes forth is one that we will accept the concept that the testimony showed that Preston Chrysler people said they didn't know it was that. Now, accepting that and not hearing by the ad and by the fact that they are car dealers and in a better position to find out whether or not they have a direct from the Chrysler Corporation factory special damage or not, assuming that they had no knowledge of this, the question then boils down, as this court is asked to hear discussion on, as to whether or not under the general statement that it is unlawful to have a deceptive false trade practice, that making a representation without having knowledge that the representation is false is a deceptive trade practice. It is our belief that the Court of Appeals, the Fifth Supreme Judicial District, is wrong in applying this doctrine of fraudulent concealment in this deceptive trade practice actually, and holding that knowledge is required. The petitioner's understanding of reading the Pennington case, which was the last discussion by this court, in regard to question of knowledge and intent under 17.46B and 17.50A and subsection.
Well, I wasn't telling you, I looked up the first place he represented that like me.
Yes, it was.
The trial court found that the representation was made because both engines were like me.
Yes, there was a finding in that. The court, this court, stated in the Pennington case that they did not find it necessary to reach the question whether or not the knowledge or intent, that it was intended to be that way, was necessary to its decision, finding that the evidence showed that it was a misrepresentation, as under the laundry list, and did not go any further in saying specifically that knowledge and intent were requirements under 17.46A. Now, since that time, of course, the legislature has amended the Deceptive Trade Practice Act again, and under the laundry list has included a section, subsection 23, which now does call for, says that disclosure, knowing disclosure, or failure to disclose something they knew was there is what will be the Deceptive Trade Practice Act. That was not in effect at the time of this purchase, nor was it in effect at the time of the trial. The language in Pennington, in discussing the need for knowledge and intent, which was raised, used very strong language in pointing out that under the interpretation of the Deceptive Trade Practice Act, following the guidelines in the Act itself, in which the court is called to have to give liberal interpretation to the provisions to carry out the purposes of it, it was stated in regard to 17.46B and 17.50 in the question of triple damages, and I will quote court's language to underscore our point. Although liability for treble damages is harsh and imposed upon a seller who is not found to have made misrepresentations knowingly, we are unable to say that liability for unknowingly made misrepresentations goes beyond reasonableness in furthering the Act's purpose. A purchaser should be able to presume that a seller is familiar with the item being sold and that the seller will not make representations about it when he's ignorant of the factual basis for his statement. One of the facts in the case is that the salesman or person official involved in testing price for Plymouth and dealing with the Robinsons was a new car sales manager. Now, in this particular situation, I believe that by using this doctrine of fraudulent concealment and requiring that under the Act that the seller has knowledge when in other portions of the Deceptive Trade Practice Act, knowledge or intent is not required, that we are giving the seller a two-way stretch. They can make a representation, and we have here in the ad direct factual cycle, and then can say, we did not know that there was some defect that makes the representations that were made be false, and therefore we have no duty to disclose what we did not know.
Would it make any difference if there's a letter from Chrysler saying we are shipping you new cars or factory cars to the dealer, and the dealer advertised that they were new, and they were not? Would you stick the dealer in?
Well, if they advertised something that was new and and it wasn't new and they had exact evidence.
Well, with me, the Chrysler had somebody in Detroit where we are shipping you new cars, the factory new. So the dealer advertised it, factory new. I didn't know whether new or not. If you were sticking in those circumstances.
Well, the dealer at that point, of course, would have a representation made to him, and I would. Then you'd be under question as to whether or not the dealer would be a consumer under the
statute. The question is whether the dealer, he doesn't know it's true or false, but he advertises that they're new, and you say it's false, therefore the dealer is.
I think that the dealer is in a position, superior position in relationship to the buyer, to find out whether or not.
You don't mean the dealer got to find out under every car he gets, do you?
Well, if he's going to sell you a car that he tells you is good and we've got a factory purchase, how is he supposed to know? They don't sell what's not supposed to, is my understanding, if I'm going to go buy a car. if I get in the car and drive it, and it seems to drive all right, I'm in a position of either being ignorant or credulous, as the words are used in the thing, and I'm going to depend upon the dealer. The dealer is in a superior position. Now, if I knew...
You're sure under your supposition, he isn't sure that that's a new car. Right?
He is assured that the car he has is as it's presented to him. And therefore, under the original, our understanding of the original deceptive trade practices, that the buyer is not in the equal position with the seller. In discussions in the doctrine of fraudulent concealment, one of the, in this court in Storms versus Tuck, 579 Southwest 2nd, 447, talked about the on the principle of estoppel by silence and fraud by silence, indicated in a note that, of course, the relationship of the parties can be critically important, as whether the fiduciary relationship or the silent party, because of its superior knowledge and judgment of the subject matter, lulls the other party into uncritical acceptance of the silence. So even under this doctrine of fraudulent concealment, there is an area in there that looks at the relationship of the parties. The reason that we take the position that the application of the doctrine of fraudulent concealment is improperly applied is our position that it does not apply where there is a statute such as the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. The Deceptive Trade Practices Act, which basically is based upon the concept of an old court action of misrepresentation in the common law, has been expanded by this remedy that the legislature enacted. It not only expanded the remedy available for misrepresentations or concealments, or whether they're knowing or not, it also discarded some common law elements. And one of the elements that we are saying should be recognized that was discarded under the Deceptive Trade Practice Act is when failure to disclose lulls the person into accepting the position, whether the seller knows or not, that is one of the elements that has been removed by the Deceptive Trade Practice. And underscoring that is the fact that the legislature decided that they would not make it as expansive in the 1979 amendment to the Deceptive Trade Practices Act to place under the laundry list of those violations the failure to disclose knowingly. That's correct. And I believe that's the language that was stated in Pennington under 17.46B, where, and that has been interpreted in the Jim White case that's referred to in an application.
In other words, there's each either in this instance to be penalized for saying something true without checking.
That's correct. And I believe that was the purpose of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. The act is one to expand what some remedies that you would or would not have under the common law. Under the common law, I'm afraid that the dealer, if he didn't have the Deceptive Trade Practice Act, could represent that he had a factory direct special purchase and allow a new car sales manager to discuss it with you, allow you to drive off with it, and say he did not know that it was damaged. When I don't know how they make a car make ready for you to buy it when it comes from the factory, or at least implied to come from the factory, whether it does or doesn't. The car has to be made ready somewhere in a dealership, and in making it ready, at that point, I would believe that the dealership was in a position to determine whether or not there was some damage or not on this direct factory check. So it is our position that according to the testimony in the trial, they were left with the impression that it was. They were dealing with it.
They paid a lot less for it.
They paid a lot more than they would have paid according to the testimony had they known that there was some damage or that it was a used car. I did not actually try the case, so I can't answer the question directly as to whether they paid a lot more. They paid, according to my understanding of the testimony, they believed they would get a better deal because they were the leftover factory purchases in 1975, buying a 74 model leftover from the factory in 1975 when the new models were already out. I believe this was the understanding by the testimony in the trial that the buyer had. This court refused to read into the terms of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act in Pennington the intent requirement and knowledge requirement merely to restrict the scope of the act covered. And Jim Walter Holmes' case that we did cite in the application for writ of error took the view that in that case, in that opinion, in the Court of Appeals in Beaumont, we have no error occurred in rendering judgment to the plaintiff on a claim under 17.46A of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, even though the defendant contended there was no evidence that its conduct was intentional or knowing. And the Beaumont Court stated that the issue has been foreclosed by the decision in Pennington. Now, it is our position that the language in Pennington is strong enough to foreclose the question that under the original Deceptive Trade Practice Act, for an unlisted act or claim under 17.46A, that no knowledge is required, and that a failure to disclose the defect when the seller was in a better position to have found out would have been a reckless representation, would have been a representation of fact that was not true, and therefore that the seller would be liable for that representation, whether he knew or not. There are other acts that don't require any knowledge on behalf of the seller, and they were in 1746B at that time. There were four sections that did specifically state knowledge or intent was a requirement, but not the other. And that indicates the legislative intent to show that not every transaction, omission to disclose, or representation, misrepresentation, requires knowledge or intent by the seller. Case of Sam Montgomery Oldsmobile Company versus Johnson, which came down after after our application for writ of error was filed. That's at 624 Southwest 2nd, 237, and that was decided by the Houston Court of Appeals. In the motor home, in that case, was sold to the buyer as a new vehicle. Now there, they did not disclose that the thing had been sitting on the lot for quite a long time, and that they had used cannibalization as the term used in the instead of having new parts in some of it, there were parts taken from other mobile homes that wound up in there. In discussing this not voluntarily telling the buyers that the motor home was on the sale block for 11 months without regular maintenance, the court held that was deceptive, and then held that the non-disclosure occurrence fell under 17.46A, and recited again that the basic purpose of the act shown by the legislative intent is to guarantee the consumer the greatest possible knowledge about any potential undesirable features of the product. And that in that case, it's another indication that under 17.46A, non-disclosure does not require knowledge. If this purchase occurred today, under the present state, 17.46A, then the question of damages in this case, assuming that it's excessive that the dealer did not know that it was damaged, though he had represented it as a factory special, direct from the Chrysler Corporation, then it would have to be shown that there was not. And that, in this case, no, because the act at that time did not require it. would ask that this court reverse the Court of Appeals decision and affirm the judgment of the trial court, or in the alternative, and I will attempt on rebuttal to get into some other issues, remand it so that the question of damages on the second point of the knowing that the vehicle was leased and not disclosing that, whether or not the damage question was sufficient to give judgment to the plaintiff, or whether or not that could be reheard and give the plaintiff a chance to obtain the damages under it.
Thank you, counsel. Of course, take a brief recess before the argument.
May it please the court, I'm Charles Duran representing Preston Chrysler Plymouth, which I may refer to as the defendant or Preston Chrysler Plymouth interchangeably with your court's permission during the course of the argument. I would like to bring out a few additional facts that were not brought out by the petitioner in this case, the plaintiff in this case. There's no question this was not a new vehicle. There were some 1,800 miles on it, which was represented by the testimony and indeed the sales slip, the sales contract between the parties reflected 1,800 miles on it. It was sold as a new car, as a car with an extended warranty. So it has some of the characteristics of a used car in the sense it has mileage, but it also had a little bit more in the sense that Chrysler sold it with an extended warranty, which provided a little longer period of time the car would be under warranty. Now, as contrasted from a new car also, the Robinsons had the opportunity and, in fact, did drive the car. And as you can easily understand, when you buy a new car frequently, you don't buy that, don't drive that precise car, you drive a demonstrator. But in this case, they had the opportunity the night that they first saw the car, at least driving it twice. And they, furthermore, had the opportunity to have the very car that they bought inspected, take it to somebody. They were forced to take a car that was sitting on the shelf somewhere. They were dealing with the actual car that they have had to this day.
I don't imagine your dealer invited them to go ahead and test it, did you?
Your Honor, there was testimony in there, and my questions to the court, to the witness, did they have an opportunity to inspect it? And they said they did have an opportunity to inspect it. Salesman testified that he'd never refused anybody an opportunity to inspect the car.
Well, it might go down to Chrysler, buy a car. Why would I want to take it over to give it to be inspected?
If it's a new car, you wouldn't. But if you buy a used car, you have the ability. I'm not saying that they shouldn't have or couldn't have. We're talking about here, in response to some questions that were raised by the plaintiff in this case, it's the opportunity to inspect and opportunity.
Your first 2 points are a lot better than this one.
All right. Okay. Okay. All right. The very fact that they had an opportunity to see the car and drive the car is, to some degree, a disclosure of any open and obvious defects.
Now, that would rule out all defects. You go to be up there, somebody's going to go down there to pick it up and you see the car.
I think that would be true of open and obvious things, but here we're talking about a hidden defect. We're talking about a cosmetic defect. We're talking about a defect that wasn't discovered by the plaintiff until 7 months after they purchased it, when they performed their own type of non-destructive testing. They had an accident with this car. Somebody hit them. And the lady testified, and this is basically the only testimony about the damage to the car, that she saw a piece of Bondo fall out of the car. Now, we had the car from the testimony from January the 16th is when we bought the car. And it was bought in Alabama, and I'm assuming that we can give our dealership a day or two to come bring the car to Texas from Alabama. The car was sold to them and delivered to them on February the 5th. So the car was in our possession at the most 2 to 3 weeks. They had the car for 7 months before they discovered anything. And that was only the result of an accident. So we're saying that this was not a basic defect with the car. We're talking about a cosmetic defect with the car. We're talking about something that couldn't have been discovered by anybody for the normal looking at a car. And you talk about make ready, you talk about things like that. The Robinsons testified that they had people in their family who were had done body work. Their stepfather was a mechanic, had his own garage. They had seen the car. They didn't even discover these defects, as they said, in the car for this period of time. Now, at the time of trial, please note that we're talking about in February of 1980, this case was tried. Some 5 years after they purchased the car in February of 1975. Testimony was they had still had the car. They had over 70,000 miles on the car. So we're not really talking about an engine that blew up or some sort of a damage to the car that really impaired the basic use of the car. So they got the use of the car as they intended. Now, there was no testimony other than lay testimony about any previous damage to the car. There was some evidence introduced in the trial that indicated that there were some welds, that instead of one type of weld, there was some spot weld. That was the only, and there was no expert testimony, so we're coupled with Mr. Robinson testifying that he noticed some unusual type of weld to the car, and we've got testimony that there was some Bondo that dropped out of the car when it was hit by another car. Now, another thing I think the court
what
should
do... Bondo?
Bondo is a slang term, Your Honor, for some type of body cut. And it's customarily used, in my knowledge, it's not in the record, of course, but it's customarily used, in my knowledge, by body men to smooth off the surface and to make things come together. I think it's also interesting to look at the background history of this case. The record transcript shows that the plaintiff filed suit originally against my client, Preston Chrysler Plymouth, and Chrysler Corporation. Chrysler Corporation then produced evidence that satisfied the trial court. They didn't sell the car to us and therefore was let out of the case. We then turned around and sued Chrysler Leasing Corporation because that's who we bought the car from. And this is prior to the amendments to the Zephyr Trade Practice Act that allowed a third-party action over against someone else, and so they were let out of the case. So we're left here as the sole defendant in this case without having any recourse to the people we bought the car from, who during the period of time they had it, some, if there was any damage, some damage or some changes were done to the car.
Give you another problem? Did you represent you bought it from Chrysler?
No, sir. We've always told we bought it from Chrysler Leasing. Okay. Now, you're talking about the advertising.
You bought it from Chrysler Leasing Factory?
No, Your Honor. We're talking about are we talking about the advertisement? Of course, the case wasn't tried on misrepresentation. We're talking about advertising. We're talking about special shipment of leftover Chrysler's and Plymouth just arrived. And then special factory purchase direct from Chrysler. But this is Plymouth up here. The special factory purchase talks about Chrysler station wagon. Talks about Chrysler down here. So we're saying that whatever the ad says, that was the thing that got them in the dealership. If that's it. That plus their own testimony, they looked at other cars, they were going to other car dealerships. Some reason or other, they came to our dealership. But when they came and looked at the car, observed the car, had an opportunity to drive the car, I don't see that there's any connection with who sold the car to them because this is a used car. This is not a new car. They didn't rely on the fact that they didn't testimony, they didn't rely on the fact it wasn't tried on that basis, so we don't feel that the advertisement has any dealing or any bearing upon the case at hand.
That's
it wasn't tried on that side. So somebody didn't think that was a representation, either the counsel for the plaintiff or the trial judge.
Was misrepresentation requested, issued for misrepresentation? That's all we've been talking about this morning, is misrepresentation.
I don't think so, Your Honor. It was tried on non-disclosure.
I was under the impression, I had that transcript issue, I was under the impression that misrepresentation issued for misrepresentation.
It's been 2 years for me too, Your Honor, and I didn't review those.
Well,
but,
it's never for me. I
understand that. If you give me a moment to look and see, I'll see the issues here. All right, the first one. Failure to disclose. Issue was requested. Did you find the Preston represented it was a particular standard or quality when it was of another? That was a requested issue.
That's what we get out of that. That's what we get out of that. You left something that got some new cars. 75s are out, so just like you see today. You know, the 82s are out. But we've got a handful of 81s here that we can make the real price.
Oh, I understand that. There was a requested issue here, a particular standard, but the trial judge did not submit those. It must have been during the course of the trial that there wasn't any evidence introduced, so he didn't feel like there was any basis for that.
Well, did the representative of Preston at the trial state that he did not know where this car came from and could not account for that 1,800 miles?
One of the witnesses testified that he said that they didn't tell us where the miles came from. One of the witnesses testified, Mrs. Robinson testified that the man told her he didn't know where the miles came from. That's what he testified that he told her, that he didn't know where the miles came from. She asked him was a demonstrator. He said no. She asked him, was it a salesman's car? He said, no. She said, where did he get the miles? Where did they get the miles in this car? He said, they don't tell us where we get the miles, where they got the miles in this car. So, to that extent, that was the testimony on that.
Then I believe, the manager made the salesman say that he knew at the time that it was a lease car?
The vice president and general manager testified that he knew from the records that it was a lease car. But that these records were not available to the salespeople during the period of time. We're talking again about a car that came into the dealership sometime after January 16th and was being talked about within 2 weeks after that period of time.
Well, I think you have to admit, though, Counselor, the internal working of the car on your part, as far as representation is concerned, it's really immaterial.
All right.
Now, on the concealment, I can understand undisclosed damage. But if you took on this representation, same question asked the other counsel. Is it, do you agree with him that the Deceptive Trade Practice Act would cover a situation where if your dealership made a representation, this is a new car direct from the factory, when in fact it was not, whether they knew it or not, if that representation were made without your people checking it to determine if it was true, and they made that representation to the buyer, that the Deceptive Trade Act would cover that.
If it was a direct representation, it may very well cover that. But there's no evidence of that fact in this case.
Are those ads in evidence?
Those ads are in evidence. But there is a great dispute as to what cars were covered by those ads. The sales manager says that these were not the cars covered by this ad. Mrs. Robinson said she came out there and this is what she thought was the car.
Wasn't that a fact question for the jury?
Yes, but there was no issue submitted on that side.
Did they not find a misrepresentation?
No, Your Honor. They found failure to disclose prior damage. They found failure to disclose prior use of the lease car.
And the misrepresentation issue was requested and not granted?
Yes, Your Honor. I think from looking at this, a quick look, my impression is that it was. So that would be it.
So I assume it's your position that misrepresentation to be out of this case.
It wasn't tried on that as far as the facts are concerned. So it's completely out, and I think that what we're here before this court is the novel idea of whether or not, because when you look, let me back into this concept. When you look at the prior use of leases, as a lease talk, that was admitted by us, that we knew it was prior use of the lease talk. That issue was taken care of by the Court of Civil Appeals because there was no evidence of any damage. No question was asked what amount of money, et cetera, because of your prior use of lease talk. So that question goes out for a failure to prove any damages on that. So we're left with simply the question, is there a duty to disclose something that you don't know?
What was the wording of the damage issue? I think the jury got $800,000.
Yes, Your Honor. It was a very simple, what amount of, it was based upon what amount of, do you feel the car to be worth at the time you purchased. I think it was a...
The difference in value in the time of purchase.
No, I think what was the amount, the issue I believe is what was the amount of, what was the fair market value of the car at the date of purchase? And I believe the court, they came back with, I think, $4,000. And the actual evidence was that they paid $4,800 for the car, plus tax, title, and license. And so that's how the trial court came up with the $800 difference.
So the jury didn't say this is because of body damage, or this is because of leasing. They just said this is the difference in value.
That's true, but the only evidence was Mrs. Robinson testifying by her with her expertise as a used car shopper that she looked around and she felt like that a car in this present condition and so forth like that would be worth $3,000. We brought in an expert witness who testified he'd bought many cars and so forth like that, and he testified that the fair market value of the car in a damaged condition. Any lease, previously leased condition, my recollection is, I could be wrong, was approximately the same price that we sold the car. And in the trial of the case, we opened our books to the jury as to how much profit we made on the car and everything else like that. The profit was less, far less than the $800 difference between the jury found. And my recollection is something like $250, $300. I could be wrong, but that was my recollection. So how much we paid for the car versus what we sold the car. So what I'm saying is really, I think that the issue here is do we have a duty to disclose something we did not know under the deceptive trade practice as it was in that time? Now, both the Court of Civil Appeals in the oral argument to them and this court now appears to agree that this is a case of first impression on this. This is not a failure to disclose case, because by using the term failure to disclose, you imply that you have some knowledge. It's a non-disclosure case, a non-disclosure of fact. Now,
tell me the difference between those two again.
Well, failure to disclose, the way I think about it, Your Honor, implies that you have knowledge of something and you don't tell it. When you fail to do something, you didn't tell it. Non-disclosure means you didn't tell something whether you know it or not, in my way of thinking. Now, under Cameron versus Terrell & Garrett, the court stated that in all interpretations of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, its primary objective is to ascertain the legislature's intent. And went through some discussion about what words were excluded and what words were included in the language of the act, and it said that any word excluded from the statute must be presumed to have been excluded for a purpose. Now, we're faced here with a 1979 amendment which adds a failure to disclose or a non-disclosure addition to the act. Now, all of us, I think, have conceded that it didn't apply to the act at that time. says, the failure to disclose information concerning goods or services which was known at the time of the transaction. You see, Your Honor, there again, you use both a failure to disclose and a word known. That's why I say there is a difference between a non-disclosure and a failure to disclose, because a failure to disclose indicates that you have knowledge of it and you just don't do it. When such failure to disclose this information was intended to induce the consumer. So we have two tests now. We have a failure to disclose, a knowledgeable failure to disclose, and an intention to induce someone to do something. So the Ozona Realty case, which is handed down by this court, it's our feeling that case says that this court could find no evidence of any misrepresentations, and it says either language either affirmatively or by omission concerning the tendency of the house to flood. As in our own case here, the only suggestion was that the real estate firm should have known of the flooding. So the plaintiff is asking you to do in this case is to read into the 1975 Act, as it was tried in this case, both knowledge and intent. And we submit that the case cited by the plaintiff in this case, the Sam Montgomery Oldsville Company versus Johnson case, is easily distinguishable because there was a case where there was failure to disclose something that was known to the dealership. Let me read. The motorhome was sold to appellees as a new vehicle with no disclosure to appellees that replaced parts in their vehicle were not factory, but in fact been fabricated by Montgomery. They held in that case that was a deceptive trade practice act. But that's distinguishable in this case, as is the Chrysler Plymouth City versus Guerrero case, which is out of the San Antonio Court of Civil Appeals, where they have knowledge. Now, there was no evidence and not even any issue submitted to the jury as to whether or not such knowledge was known to the defendant in this case. If the court holds that in 1975, we have to have knowledge, you don't have to have knowledge, it seems to me that what you're making holding is that there's strict liability for the sale of goods.
That's exactly what the holding would be, just like in the case of a product's liability.
Right.
The manufacturer created the defect, whether he knows about it or not, he's strictly liable.
Right. Okay. And then where does that take us, Your Honor, with the new 23, which came into effect in 79, where they go back and they say, wait a minute, the legislature says, wait a minute, the failure to disclose information concerning goods or services which was known at the time of the transaction, if such failure to disclose was intended to induce. So we have a window here where during the 75 to 79 period, there's strict liability, and then the legislature comes in here and sweeps this aside and makes this court holding no good, invalid. And remember, this 23 was not intended, as I perceive it, as a corrective, not intended to correct or change the law. It was intended to elaborate on something that wasn't addressed before. And so I'm saying, my feeling is to this court, that this court shouldn't try to fill that gap when it becomes ridiculous if they do hold, as the plaintiff asked, that you don't have to have knowledge. That as of today, in today's world, this section governs us, and we don't have to have, and you have to have knowledge and you have to have intent. And it seems to me that we'd be doing something that's pretty much of a useless act, except that it might apply to this particular case, and obviously that's one I'm most interested in at this time, and I'd like to see it sustained. Because the 79 Act would immediately change the law if the court held that way. Finally, as far as the final issue of whether or not the case should be remanded, I believe Justice Greenhill has spoken in the National Life and Accident versus Blagg case, that if you send it back, it may just allow the court to have, or the plaintiff to have another bite at the apple. Now, we believe the case was fully developed on the facts. We believe the case was fully tried on the novel state of the law as it was at that time. We don't feel the case should have even been brought. We don't feel like that this case would do any good for anybody to go back and retry it. The law has changed. We don't feel like that there's going to be any benefit. We have we can show the factual situation is not going to change. The Robinsons are going to come in there and probably drive in the same car at the same time they were 2 years ago. And so we urge the court to sustain the Court of Civil Appeals position. We feel it is fully based upon the facts and the law in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The argument is closing from petitioner.
May it please your honors, I do not see and cannot agree that failure to disclose does not involve the concept of a misrepresentation. If it is true that the Deceptive Trade Practices Act is based primarily on and going further than the common law action for misrepresentation, a failure to disclose with some knowledge in there would still involve failure to disclose something that is not true. There's still a representation involved. In fact, in other words, I think what respondent is saying is that he wishes his silence to be golden. And if he wishes his health that way, I think that he must look upon the fact that the legislature understood the concept of knowledge. What is interesting in the definitions of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, and I must correct the statement, this was under the 73 Act. It was not tried at the time that the 1975 amendments were in effect. This case was tried in January. The purchase of the car was in early part of 1975, and I do not believe that the amendments of the 75 amendments were in effect because the legislature had not met at the time that the purchase of the automobile occurred. In the definitions under 17.45 of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, as it was in effect at the time, under subsection 9 it said, knowingly means actual awareness of the falsity or deception, but actual awareness may be inferred where objective manifestations indicated that a person acted with actual awareness. An ad that says it's direct from Chrysler Corporation, factory purchase, is an obvious manifestation of some awareness. And we have an admission by counsel for respondent that it was known even before the trial that it was a leased car.
I'm still confused. Was there an issue on misrepresentation?
It was requested. It was pled and requested, and the court did not give it. Instead, wound up just asking the jury, did they fail to disclose the damage? Did they fail to disclose that it was a leased car? The jury answered yes to both issues, and all the judge would allow to go to the jury was, were the Robinsons adversely affected, and the jury found yes, requested.
Now, has the failure to submit the issue been brought forward as an assignment of error?
It was was brought up, it's our position, it was waived by the other side. This has been the problem.
Waived by the other side?
Because it was requested by plaintiffs, and it was refused by the court. They did not object to it.
But you didn't get the issue.
We didn't get the issue. Our position is that the court found that knowledge wasn't required, and all it had to find out there was a non-disclosure, and that in effect he found, as a matter of law, if you will, that there was a misrepresentation under 1746A. I think the confusion in the trial court, where there were requested issues that were not given and no objections by the respondent, is the fact that at the time the Court of Appeals in Dallas had reversed and rendered Pennington.
Well, at this time, of course, here comes the Fifth Court of Appeals reversing and rendering in Robinson, and they did not mention the effect of Pennington on this case whatsoever. This court, in effect, has dropped the first shoe, and maybe that the Court of Appeals in Dallas is waiting for the second shoe to drop. We would ask that this court drop that second shoe and allow this case to stand as the language in Pennington indicated, that knowledge is not required, that there's been a misrepresentation, and that, as found by the jury, and that there was a failure to disclose whether or not the seller knew or intended that. We really, in effect, I was thinking that responded as he started arguing, wound up admitting that there was a violation under 17.46A. If so, and if the Robinsons were adversely affected, then the judgment of the Court of Appeals should be reversed. The judgment of the trial court should be affirmed. The problem with the damages issue and why it should be remanded, there, the questions given to the jury in the trial court did touch upon the element of damages. And therefore, if that is not complete enough, it was the reasoning of the Court of Appeals that they couldn't find any evidence and couldn't accept the concept that the trial court impliedly inferred found the damages, since the issues that were presented to the jury and found in favor of the Robinsons in effect indicated they found damages, that is a necessary element. And also the question regarding the misrepresentation that Your Honors have asked about in this case, the plaintiffs below in the trial court felt that there was a question of misrepresentation. We still feel there was. And therefore, it would not be another bite of the apple if this court decides that knowledge is required. If it does, then the question of the misrepresentation was not allowed to be developed in the trial court, and it therefore should be remanded to allow it to be developed. We ask that the court again reverse the Court of Appeals and affirm the judgment of the trial court based on the arguments presented, or in the alternative, that it be remanded to allow the other necessary issues to be brought up.
Counsel, you cited just a case that I did not find in your brief in Houston, and I did not get the site when you told us about it earlier.
Now,
that one done the old versus Johnson.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Six 24 seconds, is that the one?
I'm going to have to go through my notes. I don't have it open at the moment.
24 seconds,
327.
All right. Yeah, 624,
237. I'll have to, I will look at it and supply that from my notes as soon as I can get to it. If you wish me to stand up here and look for it, I will.
No, 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 just send us a letter and a copy to the post.
Oh, so thank you.
On the other side.
Case is submitted on written briefs and oral argument for both parties. This concludes the oral submissions for the morning, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
Audience, please rise.